It's easy to think that women in America won the right to vote in 1920 when the 19th Amendment took effect. But women in the U.S. won the right to vote by degrees. And in Illinois, a really big degree took place 100 years ago this week. 7 years before the 19th Amendment, Governor Edward Dunn signed a bill giving women in Illinois the right to vote for president and in local elections, on top of the right to vote for school officials, which had been granted 2 decades earlier. All in all, it was the most voting power won by women in any state east of the Mississippi at that time. Today on Focus, we'll talk with two historians, Mark Sorensen and Western Illinois University Professor Virginia Boynton, about the Illinois women and some men who fought for years for women's voting rights and how a crazy, radical idea became the status quo. I'm Jim Meadows. Focus is coming your way right after this hour's news. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Let's say it's 1880, and you live in Illinois, and you think women should have the right to vote. Who are you? Are you rich or poor? What sort of education do you have? Which is your political party affiliation, if any? What do the neighbors think of you? And what's going on in society that convinces you that votes for women is one of the urgent causes of your time? Our guests today can give some answer to that question, as well as how women's suffrage efforts played out in Illinois. We know the eventual result, but to get an idea of how the rise was along the way, let's talk to our guest in the studio today and on the phone. Both have written about the women's suffrage movement and in Illinois, and both have ties to the Illinois State Historical Society. Mark Sorensen is the group's immediate past president, and Western Illinois University history professor Ginny Boynton serves on the Society's board of directors. And Mark and Ginny, welcome to Focus.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you.
Okay. And as I understand, tomorrow is the anniversary of the signing of a bill in Illinois which gave women limited voting rights.
That's correct. Governor Edward Dunn signed it, and he had a photo opportunity, women surrounding him in the state capitol. And I think tomorrow the Peoria Journal-Star is going to have a special feature on that.
So 7 years before the 19th Amendment, and women in Illinois could already vote for president. And Ginny, was that a big deal? Was that something that the rest of the nation noticed, or was the rest of the nation already getting on the bandwagon?
Oh, it was hugely important. Carrie Chapman Catt, who was the head of the National Women's Suffrage Association, commented that suffrage sentiment doubled in the United States after Illinois women got the right to vote. Our state was the most populous state in which women got presidential voting rights at that point, the only state east of the Mississippi, east of Kansas, in fact, where women had presidential voting rights. So it was seen as a mainstream place for it to happen as opposed to out there in the Wild West.
Okay. Well, if you have questions about women's suffrage and its history in Illinois, we have two people who can answer your questions. Call us at 333-9455. Our call is toll-free at 1-800-222-9455. That's 333-WYLL, 800-222-WYLL. And you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We also welcome your questions on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. And you said out there in the Wild West, where the Western states had some of them had given women the right to vote earlier than Eastern states.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we don't think of Western states necessarily as being on the political cutting edge of expanding rights today necessarily. What was going on?
Well, the people who moved west, and particularly the men, who, of course, were the ones who had to decide whether to give women the right to vote or not, in the West, they were more adventurous, I guess you could say. They were more willing to take chances and do things that hadn't been done before. That was partly what attracted people to the West. There were a lot of suffrage leaders in the East, in New York and Massachusetts and elsewhere, but they had lots of trouble mobilizing support.
Okay.
In the East.
What was the landscape of debate about women's suffrage in the late 19th century in Illinois? How was it being talked about?
Let me go back to the 1870 Constitution. So what happens is the
this is the 1870 Illinois
Constitution.
Right? We've had several. Yes.
We've had four, and the women come down to Springfield before the Constitutional Convention in 1870, and they want to have equal rights with what would be called Negro men at that time, and so African-American men are going to get the vote through a federal amendment, and the women can't get that federal amendment, and they want the Illinois Constitution to allow them to vote, and they fail in 1870. And what happens then is that the 1870 Constitution has a provision that no changes can be made for 20 years. And, in fact, that whole Constitution is not superseded until 100 years later in 1970. So the women take a legislative tack eventually, and that's where in 1913, as Dr. Boynton said, this is the first law that's passed legislatively, a legislative effort to allow women to vote, where all the other previous ones were amendments to the Constitution or creations of constitutions.
Now, just from something I was reading in the early 1890s, so I guess soon after that 20-year limit was passed, Illinois granted women a very limited right to vote for, I guess, school officials.
School elections, school officials, yeah.
And also including, I guess, the University of Illinois Board of Trustees, so that they ended up actually having a female trustee at that time.
Yes, Lucy Flower was elected in 1894, which was the first statewide election that Illinois women could vote in, was the Illinois Board of Trustees election.
What was the tenor of the debate? What were people talking about when they decided whether or not that was a good idea?
Well, Lucy Flower was a Chicago Board of Education, had been appointed to the Chicago Board of Education. And when the Supreme Court ruled that women could serve at the U of I trustees, certain women pushed her, but Governor Altgeld appointed a Democrat, so Julia Holmes Smith was actually the first woman to serve as trustee, but Flower was elected citywide. And it's interesting to me about history is that when I was working at the archives a number of years ago, Lucy Flower's school called me up from Chicago and asked me where their name came from. So it's sad that they had forgotten all the tradition that went into that Garfield Park area school. So,
and I'm wondering what was the nature of the idea that school officials were okay for women to vote for in the 1890s, but
well,
not
in
other...
general, women's voting was seen as to the extent it was appropriate for issues that concern family, so things that affected their children like schooling. It was less threatening than the idea of women having full voting rights.
Right. In 1873, a law is passed allowing women the right to serve on school boards, and we have 10 county superintendents of instruction elected women at that time. And so this is just kind of an expansion of that women are the nurturers of the home, and education is part of that, so they could serve.
Before that, was it simply an idea that women were not considered appropriately responsible, or perhaps was it also the fact that public schools were expanding to a degree where these offices were existing and available when they had not been before?
I think both of those. I think that in general, voting was very identified with men. Throughout the 19th century, more and more men had been gaining the right to vote, and so by the time you get to the later 19th century, all men can vote and all voters are men. And it's just very identified as kind of part of the definition of being the head of your household, as you represent your household to the state as the voter for your family. So there just wasn't seen a need for women to have the right to vote for quite a long time.
Who were the people who were advocating votes for women at this time in Illinois? What, if you were going to give a demographic profile, who were they likely to be?
Well, a generalization would be this is a generation of women who were college educated, mm-hmm. who had gone to seminaries. And so I was thinking this morning that obviously their mothers and fathers allowed this to happen. So you, with your Susan B. Anthony's and Frances Willard's and Mary Livermore's, They had been allowed to, quote, allowed to go to college, and they were the first generation of women to do that. And the question was, what do you do now after you have this college education?
Mm-hmm.
And what was the reply they often got from the powers that be at the times? How were they treated?
Well, it might allow you to be a better conversationalist in your married life or at parties or something like that. But they had all this energy, and I think they wanted to use it. To me, the early women suffragists wanted life to be fair, and to be fair, they should have the right to vote. And I think it evolves in several ways after that.
Oh. Yes, and a lot of them came out of also other reform movements, the earliest ones from progressivism and abolitionism and the early temperance movement in the 19th century, and then later in the progressive era, they're involved in a lot of different reform activities. So voting is both a matter of principle, a matter of justice, and also what are you going to do with it? How are you going to make use of your vote?
We have a caller on the line, on line four, Peter from Orland Park. Good morning. You're on the air on Focus.
Yes, well, very interesting discussion. I have a couple of questions or perhaps your thoughts. One is that looking at the franchising of women in other countries, I've discovered that oftentimes the politics of it was that women were given the right to vote by men because many men of working class background were becoming radicalized. So I wonder if that was the case in Illinois and throughout the United States. In other words, giving the right to vote to women may have been seen as some kind of attempt to dilute the shift to the left. Also, I'm wondering whether giving the right to women to vote really mattered to many women. That is to say, was it purely or exclusively a concern of upper-class educated women, or did women in blue-collar level really care about the right to vote? And I wonder if that question could be answered by looking at who, in fact, voted after they were given the right to vote. So I'll just hang up and listen to your response on the radio. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Peter. And let's go with the first one. Did some people think that women would be a moderating force in the voting pool compared to, say, a new wave of men maybe radicalized by union membership or something like that?
Well, I think we'll go with temperance as one example. I think a lot of, like, Frances Willard, a woman from Evanston and a Methodist, her thrust was more from the temperance background, and so they were looking for a home protection, what they call a home protection bill, or local control, where that women were affected most by besotted men. So if their husbands drank away their paycheck at the saloon or came home and beat them when they were drunk or abandoned the family, the woman was greatly affected. So therefore, she should have the right to help decide whether liquor licenses were given in the local community. So that would be one angle of this. And from that standpoint, they would be opposed by German immigrants who needed their glass of beer all the time.
Yeah, there was a lot of opposition to women's suffrage among Chicago Democrats because of the temperance issue, the prohibition issue, the concern about that. And in terms of support for suffrage, it really spread across all the parties, both support and opposition, although the Progressive Party, and when you get into the 20th century, and the Socialists were more supportive of it than the Democrats and Republicans.
And I think I noticed just from one mention, the Progressive Party was a force in Illinois politics, say, at the time around 1913 when the voting rights law was passed. There were progressives in the Illinois legislature. Is that true? So that's not something. Today people just expect that it's going to be Republicans and Democrats, but it was a slightly more diverse political field out there.
Now, there were four parties. At the time of the 1913 law, there were four parties represented in the state legislature, and they worked with all four of them to get the bill through.
Democrats, Republicans, progressives, and
Socialists.
Socialists.
So they got three socialist votes,
yeah.
25 progressives, I think.
Okay. Now, Peter's second question, which is, How much interest did women show? Well, in the 1914 election, after 1913 in Illinois, the first one where women could come out and vote for president and vote in local elections, was there a sizable turnout of women?
Well, there was no presidential election until 16.
Not 60. So what had just been the local elections? They couldn't vote in the legislature or for Congress. Was there a turnout?
Well, I don't have that information. I think the presidential election was an eye-opener.
You're saying the 1916 was the real bellwether in this case?
Mm-hmm.
Let's go to 1916 then. What happened there in Illinois as far as voting turnout?
Well, it was huge. I have a statistic someplace, if I could find it. I don't know.
And we are actually looking through some materials which the State Historical Society has published on women's suffrage. You were telling me this has been distributed across the state at the public libraries.
Right. I have two different things. I'll answer the question first, and I'll go and then I'll promote our literature here.
Okay.
But when the first Illinois election took place, and it is congressional, in 1914, 250,000 women voted in Chicago. And
that's Chicago.
That's just Chicago alone. And so I think what people could see is Illinois at that time had 29 electoral votes, and if all those women participated in the next presidential election, you want to be on the side of those people that could decide the election. Now, in terms of literature that we have, the Illinois Heritage magazine is put out by the Illinois State Historical Society, and there's an article about women's suffrage in the November-December 2004 issue of that. And you can also probably find it online if you Google Ahead of Their Time, A Brief History of Women's Suffrage in Illinois.
Okay, Ahead of Their Time, and Illinois State Historical Society just by itself, well, I'm sure get you a lot of contacts.
And to follow up on that, then in 1995, while I worked at the Illinois State Archives, I helped with the Governor's Commission on commemorating the 75th anniversary of the Federal Amendment, and we created a publication that's called Illinois Women, 75 Years of the Right to Vote, and those were distributed to every school in the state of Illinois and every library in the state of Illinois, and so I checked yesterday, and there are still hundreds of them in card catalogs around southern Illinois, so you can get that because it's no longer available otherwise.
Okay, what's the name of that publication?
The name of the publication is a long name. Illinois Women, 75 Years of the Right to Vote.
And I should note that the Ahead of Their Time article, my recommendation, if you want to Google that, make sure you also add the words Illinois Women. Otherwise, the first thing you'll be finding is reference to a Frank Zappa album. This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and we're talking about the struggle for women's rights in Illinois with historians Mark Sorensen and Jimmy Boynton. Call us with your comments at 333-9455, 1-800-222-9455, or you can email your question to will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone number again is 333-WILL, 1-800-333-WILL. And you can reach us on Twitter or Facebook at Focus580. What were some of the basic arguments being made at the time in favor of women's rights to vote? What was the ground that advocates for women's suffrage were speaking from?
Well, towards the end, in particular, they were really trying to bring back the justice argument that women are citizens, women are taxpayers, women are affected by the laws that are passed, and therefore they should have some say in that, just like men did. There was also, particularly earlier in the late 19th and early 20th century, a lot of what have been called expediency arguments. The 19th century, there was a belief that women were morally superior to men. Men were out there in the grubby workplace dealing with corruption and money and so forth, whereas women were protected in the home, and therefore they were better placed to make these ethical decisions, and so they should get the right to vote because this would allow them to make sure the world was a better place and clean up government and all those sorts of things. Those arguments were used less at the end by the women in Illinois because they found that that had stirred up a lot of opposition from people who didn't necessarily want governments cleaned up and alcohol banned. So they went back to the arguments about justice.
Arguments about justice. And yes, go ahead.
So one of the arguments is how the ballot could help women would be one thing. And so the women, again, were concerned about sexual abuse and domestic violence, divorce, having their children after divorce, having them be able to keep their own wages. And so
essentially laws on the books at the time and how they affected women.
Correct. Like the age of consent. The age of consent for sexual relations was 12.
Were there also laws about women's ability, especially coming out of a marriage, whether they're widowed or divorced, in terms of owning property or inheriting property?
Correct. So you see
property rights.
Right. You see a big movement, and the Bradwell family was big on this in Chicago. But from the 1870s through the turn of the century, many laws were passed that affected this in a positive way for women. But the scary thing is that it's not until the 1982 that the Illinois Domestic Violence Act is passed. So you went all that time before you have that type of thing addressed.
Okay, but there was a thought at the time that if women could vote, then they could address some of the injustices that women were subject to in the legal system at the time.
Correct. Yeah, and then I agree with Jenny that. Another philosophy was how voting women could make the world better because they had that theory that they actually had a personality characteristics which, if were shared with the world, would make things a lot nicer.
Where were church leaders in Illinois on this subject? Would you be able to guess by a denomination what their position might be?
Well, I think the Unitarians and Universalists, the Universalists had female ministers already in the 1870s, and so I think they were supportive of this. Mary Livermore would kind of share both of those Universalists and Unitarians. Reading about Francis Willard as a Methodist, and you'd think Methodists, I associate some of that ancient Methodist with not drinking, but reading her biography, it seems like the Methodist Association would not allow her to speak or be an officer in lots of their organizations, so I'm not sure, about that. Dr. Boynton, you have some religion Quakers?
Well, I was going to say that there was slow movement on the part of some of the denominations toward limited voting rights for women, and again, in these areas that were seen as particularly linked to the family and to children. But the churches as a whole, with the exception, the big exception of the Unitarian Universalists, were not outspoken on behalf of women's voting rights, let's put it that way.
Were they outspoken against it?
Some cases, yes.
Okay.
And frequently they just kind of stayed out of it.
So it was really in that one area, the Universalist Unitarians, that you might find some interest, but not in other places as far as churches were concerned.
Not denominationally. I mean, individual ministers or pastors or church leaders, but not as a voice of the entire denomination.
Well, who were some of the big names in the women's suffrage movement in Illinois? Are there people where, if I was following the news at the turn of the last century in Illinois, that I would know who they were as far as this movement was concerned?
Well, Frances Willard, certainly.
And tell me,
let's take
a closer look at her. Tell me about Frances Willard.
Well, she became the president of the Women's Christian Temperance Union, which was the largest organization of women in the nation at the time. This was 1879. And it had an interesting approach of basically allowing local chapters to get as radical or be as conservative as they wanted. But she was an advocate of what she called the home protection ballot, which I think Mark mentioned, the idea that women should have the right to vote on liquor issues because they affected the home. And she tries to get that through Illinois, and it fails. But she's very outspoken. She is one of these people who kind of migrates towards suffrage and then eventually decides that women need to have the right to vote.
As well. I mean, she doesn't walk away from suffrage.
No. Oh, no. And she doesn't walk away from temperance.
And she doesn't walk away from temperance either.
No, no, no.
It's interesting that those two movements were to some degrees allied because now temperance will be seen as the hidebound conservative position, while Votes for Women has, of course, stayed around. And I think even, well, it's interesting, I was talking to a historian who wrote a book about Coca-Cola. And Coca-Cola was attacked by the WCTU. In its very early days, it actually contained cocaine, where you might see the point. But even after they had taken the cocaine out, the WCTU was going after it in the 1920s for the caffeine.
Mm-hmm.
And the historian thought, and the Coca-Cola company thought too, apparently accurately, that this sort of essentially typed the WCTU as being now having less commanding authority on these issues once they were just going after caffeine. And so perhaps by that point, after temperance was in place, their power started to diminish. But during the movement for women's suffrage, that was not the case.
Yeah, there was a lot of overlap in terms of personnel between the temperance movement and the suffrage movement. And to some extent, I think it hurt the suffrage movement. I mean, a lot of the resistance in Chicago in particular, because they were concerned that once Illinois women got the right to vote, they would vote out liquor. To some extent, that linkage worked to the detriment of women's voting rights.
Nowadays, there's a big gulf between Chicago politics and downstate politics. What did that gulf exist in the turn of the last century, and would you see a very different response to the women's suffrage movement in downstate Illinois 100 years ago?
Well, I was impressed that the first record of suffrage mentioned in Illinois is 1855 in Earlville, Illinois. And so what I was impressed with in my research was how many different small communities had suffrage organizations. And when the bill was passed in 1913, it said that Trout had led 100 organizations, local organizations at the time.
Earlville, a city in LaSalle County, mm-hmm. Currently about 1,800 people.
Correct. Finishing up with Frances Willard, she is the first woman to address the General Assembly, at least by several accounts, and there's several different versions of whether it was official session or whether they had recessed for lunch and she got to talk, one or the other. But her supporters had hundreds of petitions, cascading rolls of petitions, cascading down from the balcony onto the House floor.
Just long sheets of
Sheets of paper with, she had 180,000 signatures of that session for please let us vote. And they, most of the men, a couple walked out, a couple turned their backs on her. Most of them were polite, but they, you know, wouldn't pass her bill.
Was just not an idea that had traction at the time.
Right. And when she died in 1898, she was acclaimed the most famous woman in the United States by many, especially her biographers.
So and she was not just an Illinois leader.
No, she was the national leader.
Correct, international leader in this movement. And because of that, in 1905, when Illinois when they started putting statues in the Washington Capitol, Illinois picked her as one of their two statues. So she's still there and was the first woman in the Capitol.
And that's interesting. Are there other women suffrage leaders who are represented by statues at the Capitol building besides Frances Willard?
Well, this is the national capital.
And, exactly.
Right. And there was a controversy 10 or 15 years ago about the, Virginia, if you can help me, three or four women that were on a marble thing.
Yeah. I think Susan B. Anthony and Harry Stanton.
Yeah, I think they had gotten buried in the basement or something.
Yeah.
And they were
interesting.
Yeah, they were being brought out.
Okay. Well, we're going to take a short break now at 10:34. 8:34 if you're listening in the evening. We will be back in a moment with more on women's suffrage in Illinois on Focus on WILL. And we are back on Focus on WILL talking about the women's suffrage movement and that movement brought early limited women's voting rights for women in Illinois. And I believe it will be Wednesday, tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
That will be the 100th anniversary of the signing of the bill that allowed women to vote in presidential and local elections.
Correct. It was, since it was a legislative thing, the Illinois thought, and the Illinois Supreme Court agreed, that women could vote for any office that wasn't specifically mentioned in the 1870 Illinois Constitution.
So that that left out the legislature?
Left out the legislature, the congressmen.
The federal Congress as well.
Mm-hmm.
And the state constitutional offices, governor and state treasurer and things like that.
Right.
But that, but local, county, township, and municipal elections.
Right,
were
they
okay.
had to come out with actually the Secretary of State was in charge of elections at that time, and they had to come out with an actual booklet or pamphlet to help local officials know exactly what things they could vote for and what things they couldn't vote for, and based on that, going back to the 1890s when women were allowed to vote for the first time for school-related things, because they could only vote for certain things, Illinois was the only state to have official separate ballots mm-hmm. and separate ballot boxes for women.
So women were using a separate ballot with all those races they could not vote in left off.
Correct.
Right.
And different ballot boxes, they have to go in different voting booths? Or?
I'm not sure about the voting booths, but they had a separate box and separate books, and I'll tell you about the book in a second. But this is all kind of coincides with the 1890s adoption of the Australian ballot. So ballots...
What's the Australian ballot?
Not only is it, we think of it as being a secret ballot, but the ballot was no longer printed by the political parties. And it was no longer red or blue, so you could identify it on the outside. But it was a ballot printed by the state government and officiated so that they all looked alike from the outside.
Was straight party ticket voting more common back then than now? And if you're saying a non-Australian ballot would be a ballot from the party, they would just have that party's candidates on it?
Beforehand, before the Australian ballot, the ballot would only have your own candidates on it, I think.
So now you couldn't split your ticket.
Right, but now with the Australian ballot, you could go in secret and vote for whichever party you wanted to on that ballot. But Chicago invented the Tasmanian Dodge.
These are political terms which are totally new to me, but the Tasmanian Dodge, tell me about it.
Well, you would go in and take your ballot and go in the ballot box, into the secret place, and then you wouldn't mark your ballot, and you'd turn in an empty envelope, and you'd go across the street to the saloon and get your reward. They'd mark the ballot the way they wanted it, and then that would go back and forth like that. You just pick up an empty ballot and turn in a pre-voted ballot. And how common that was, I don't know, but some people think that happened in Cook County.
Imagine that.
Imagine, yes, indeed. Well, we were talking earlier about Frances Willard, and she was an important leader for women's voting rights in the late 19th century. She passed away around 1898. Of course, the anniversary we're talking about didn't happen until 1913.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the names I saw being brought up in terms of the 1913 bill is Grace Wilbur Trout. Can you tell me about her?
Yeah, we should probably talk about Catherine Wall McCulloch first. Yeah.
Okay, let's go to Catherine Wall McCulloch.
Trout got better publicity because she wrote an article in our magazine, so that helped.
You mean back then?
Yes, actually, before 1920 or by 1920.
So the magazine and the title of the magazine again.
That would have been the Illinois State Historical Journal.
What is it called today?
I think that's the same title today.
Journal of the Illinois State Historical Society.
Go ahead. Journal of the Illinois State Historical Society.
Okay. Well, let's talk about Catherine Wall McCulloch. And was she really a driving force behind the movement that led to the 1913 law?
Let's see.
Yes and no. She had been the legislative leader for the Illinois Equal Suffrage Association for, I think, about 20 years, had been representing the suffrage movement in Springfield. She was an attorney, very outspoken, and had been working for many years to try to get something like this through. But she and Grace Wilbur Trout were not the best of friends, let's say. They had different approaches and different backgrounds. And when Trout was elected president of the association, McCulloch sort of backed out of the legislative role for a while, and Grace Wilbur Trout got her people in there. And so at the end, they're kind of at odds about how to do this. how to go through this problem.
They shared a common goal, but tactics and strategies may have been different.
Yeah, and even the goal was a little bit different at times because McCullough really would have liked to get a constitutional amendment to give women full voting rights in Illinois. And the governor had said he would not support that, so Trout was fine, we'll work with what you're willing to support, which is what they ended up getting, the presidential and municipal suffrage.
But McCullough would have preferred to keep on going for all the
moments. Yeah, she saw that as kind of a sellout to partial suffrage. And so, I mean, they both essentially wanted the same thing, but Trout was much more, she called it diplomatic, much more genteel in her approach to legislators as opposed to McCullough, who was much more confrontational.
Right.
That's the right word.
Right. And you can, right. And yeah, brash. Catherine Waugh McCulloch was really interested in the law, and she got her law degree. And in her biography, it talks about the fact that when she wanted to get a clerkship to get into a law firm, that's two of the firms, the men wanted to trade sexual favors for her lawship clerking. So she was not, you know, happy about any of that business. Now, she was married. She's from Evanston, and Trout will be from Oak Park, and so both communities will kind of claim whatever they are. But going back to that thing about the upper class, lower class business, one little theory is that McCullough represented the working middle class aspect of women, and Trout was the new club women who weren't necessarily college educated, but they had a lot more money. And so,
Wealthy, so
after 1900, the new women's clubs turned their attention to suffrage. And when that happened, that got a big push. And so you had this, as Jenny said, genteel aspect of it.
Well, if we're talking about class and other background differences in the movement, we probably ought to go to another name here in the Illinois women's suffrage movement, and that's Ida B. Wells.
Right.
Who was African-American.
And and when she was asked to get off the segregated car of the Southern Railroad, she bit the conductor and had to be bodily removed from that. And then she had to flee from Tennessee because of her anti-lynching articles, and ended up in Chicago, also married. But she started the first African-American club, Alpha Suffrage, in Chicago. And the interesting story that Trout doesn't particularly write about in her article, in her life story, is what happens in 1913 in Washington. Is that the
suffrage parade?
The suffrage parade in Washington, D.C., the day before Woodrow Wilson is to be inaugurated.
And Woodrow Wilson was the Democrat who, I could be argued, the Democrat who brought Jim Crow hiring policies to the federal workforce in Washington.
Absolutely.
He was elected in 1916.
Right. And I think this is the 1913 parade.
Yeah.
And the
march.
Right. And the women were all ready to march, and Ida B. Wells was there with the African-American women. And the southern states groups decided that the parade had to be totally segregated, that the women could not be together.
They could march, but not together.
Correct.
In the races.
Not with the rest of the Illinois women.
Right. So Grace Wilbur Trout confronted Ida B. Wells and said, "You can't march with us." And there was a big conversation you can read in various academic articles about that, but eventually Barnett said, "Okay, I won't march," and stood on the sidelines. And as the parade started and they marched, two things are going to happen. One, when the Illinois delegation gets to Barnett, she joins the women in the front of the parade, integrating the parade, and the Chicago Tribune takes pictures that puts on the front page.
Okay. Barnett, I'm sorry. I'm losing.
I'm sorry.
Ida B. Wells Barnett.
Yeah. Okay. Ida B. Wells, and then she marries Fred Barnett.
Oh, you're absolutely right.
Right. At that time, she's married, and so she uses both names some of the times. So that happens, and there's photographs of that. And the second thing that happens is the smashing up the parade by the men.
Yeah.
And some of the police. I don't know, Jenny, you have some ideas about that?
Well, I was bystanders for the parade were said to have been drinking for quite some time, preparing for the inaugural revels the next day. And for whatever reason, they got quite obstreperous and were obstructing the parade and started attacking the women, and the police either joined in or stood by, depending on which account you read.
Right.
So the parade ended up getting a huge amount of national attention in headlines across the country because every state had representatives in the parade, representative women marching in this parade, and so they're all covered back home with this great brouhaha that ensues. And as a result, the suffrage movement gets a lot of attention and a lot of sympathy in some quarters, at least, because these women were—they had a parade permit. They're just trying to, you know, march peaceably, and they get attacked for that.
Right, and this is also showing up Woodrow Wilson because it's his supposed to be his big time, and I don't know how that affects a person's personality, but it's interesting then. In 1917 and 18, he is having the women arrested that are protesting in front of the White House, and that's when you have this Iron Jaw Maidens business with them force-feeding suffragists because they go on hunger strikes.
Yes, well, I've seen photographs of Woodrow Wilson at the train station, I believe, in Washington, D.C., on the day of the parade, all alone and wondering where everybody is, and they're all off at the parade instead of greeting him when he's arriving to be inaugurated next day.
I want to get back to Ida B. Wells for just a moment and just wondering, how was that handled? How receptive were whites in the women's suffrage movement in Illinois to the idea of black women's suffrage?
Probably would depend. I think McCullough would be for it, and they were, I think, happy to have them in the movement, but they didn't want to associate with them in particular. So it's, you know, it's said that African American women had a high stake in this because they had some of the lowest paying jobs. Mm. And again, back to the sexual abuse and being taken advantage of in the workplace. And so they were looking for practical laws that would help them in this area. Now, what happens is after they do get this vote, Wells and her African American women's groups campaign in Chicago and keep their thing alive, and so they're able to elect the first black alderman in Chicago, who eventually becomes the first black congressman in the North.
Well, this is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Still time for questions on the women's suffrage issue in Illinois, something that happened 100 years ago tomorrow with the signing of a bill allowing women to vote for president and in local elections. Give us a call at 333-9455. The toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Our email address, will-talk@illinois.edu. What changed between the 19th century, say between 1898 and, say, 1913, that 15-year period, what changed which made men ready to give women even limited voting rights?
Well, the 1913 law gets passed towards the end of the progressive movement, when there's been a lot of things changing, a lot of new laws and regulations, and society is just undergoing one of its periodic social reform periods. And so in that sense, there are men in the legislature who are part of that, in all the parties, who are part of that movement and therefore more open to it. And I think also women had gotten very sophisticated in their approaches in terms of using the telephone and automobiles and, you know, whatever tools they had at their at hand in order to try to promote the cause.
And the club women were involved in this, and so and most of them were married and had families and had money, and they could influence and finance things. But what happens between 1913 and 1920 is not only does Illinois pass a law that lets women vote for president, but several other states in the East do as well in the next couple of years, and several more in the West.
And civilization did not come crashing down.
Yes.
Right. And the Republicans and Democrats now see that women, without this national amendment, women already have enough electoral votes to swing an election. In other words, there are more than half of the electoral votes now can be voted by women. So do you want to be the party that blocks women from, you know, having full franchise in the country?
I was wondering now, the work that you, I take it work that you've both done, has you've made use of the archives of the State Historical Society and elsewhere. Where did you find the most surprises in the historical record as you did your research? What sort of things did you find out that were the most of note?
For me, it's the when I was in school, high school, we didn't have any of this stuff. There was a picture of Susan B. Anthony in the American History textbook, and I think that might have been the only woman. And then through college, you learn more about this. And I think in my research in the Illinois State Archives is the number of women that participated and the number of towns in Illinois that had women's groups participating, all these small towns. So it's not just Chicago or big school intellectuals. People are involved in this all over.
Yeah, I found it impressive that the State Suffrage Association made sure that there were local suffrage associations in every state legislative district, and they used them to lobby the legislators to put constituent pressure on the legislators in their district. So they're extremely well organized, which is typical not just of the suffrage movement in Illinois, but women's reform activities in general, that they're very organized throughout the state. And that was something they really made great use of.
And what sort of documents were you able to look at through the State Historical Society? Are we talking, or did anybody leave, say, letters?
Right, yeah. We're going to differentiate. The Illinois State Historical Society that Jenny and I are associated with is a volunteer, not-for-profit organization promoting history. I worked at the Illinois State Archives, and we're the repository of state government records of permanent value. And so you would find things like we now have gotten a separate tally sheet for the 1920 elections, because they still made women vote in separate ballots after the federal amendment, because they thought the Supreme Court would surely overturn that stupid law, you know, that allowed women to vote. And so they, you know, they went ahead and did that. But also, we have legislative records, and so you have these letters from people saying that, you know, women you know, are unwilling to do favors for men, and you know, they shouldn't give them the vote. Or the women, only women who want to vote, are the ones that dress like men, and the only men that, you know, are in favor of this are dressed like women. You know, so you actually have those letters and documents in the archives.
And that's in the archives. And I should note: does the State Historical Society keep their own archives? Or
they do not. We put out the journal, and now the Illinois Heritage Magazine as well.
Okay. And is this an organization that the general public can become involved in?
Yes, they can.
Absolutely.
Said the past president. Yes,
right.
Tell me more.
So all you have to do is Google Illinois State Historical Society. We'd love to have you be a member. And the fees aren't very much. We get no state aid at all. And we're independent. And we work out of a Springfield office. And we'd love to have you involved and come to our conferences or bus trips or anything else.
It's open to anybody who's interested in Illinois history.
Okay. And I should note that their website is historyillinois.org. I think we have a caller coming in. But yes, we have it here from Florida on line one, Terry in Barefoot Bay, Florida. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Good morning. I just wanted to comment about my grandmother's experience. I grew up knowing how radically in favor of women's suffrage she was. She was born in 1889, and she got married and had daughters in 1913 and 1915. Both were graduated from high school in the early 1930s, and one was graduated from college in 1934. But the crux of this story is that my grandfather turned out to be a no-good, and he abandoned the family and never assisted her in any way in bringing this family up. And I'm just wondering if her radicalism probably stemmed from being a single mother during this time frame.
That was often the case, that women's personal experiences within their family or with legal barriers was what radicalized them and brought them to the decision that they needed to have the right to vote to represent themselves.
Well, her whole life was spent in Illinois, and she worked on some very hard jobs to accomplish what she did with those two girls.
Wow. And it sounds like she had that influence and was a supporter of the suffragist movement herself.
Well, there's no doubt about it, because I grew up always hearing how radically in favor of it she was.
Okay, and that makes me wonder, were in the early years, once women had the right to vote, and once the 19th Amendment was passed, were there people who are still wondering if opponents of it, that maybe it was a passing fad and they could undo it?
Right. They tried to undo it with various things, but Alice Paul was still active at that time and tried to pass the Equal Rights Amendment.
Equal Rights Amendment, yeah.
And you'll notice that has never passed the national or Illinois.
It's still out there, I believe.
It's dead now in terms of the time limits on the last amendment, but this is where you had blood poured in the halls of the Illinois State Capitol in 1982.
Well, that's all the time we have, and thank you to Terry for calling in from Florida, and our thanks to today's guests, Mark Sorensen and Western Illinois University Professor Ginny Boynton, for their insight into the history of women's suffrage in Illinois. Remember, tomorrow is the anniversary, 100th anniversary, of the signing of the law that gave important limited voting rights to women in Illinois. Thank you to the both of you for being on the program today.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you.
Today's show was produced by Lindsay Moon. Other members of our focus team are Pam Dempsey and Kimberly Cronick. Jason Croft is our technical director and handles your calls. Wednesday on Focus, we'll talk about public libraries. Controversy over the way old books were culled from the nonfiction section at the Urbana Free Library. It's just one example of the controversies that libraries face as they adjust the changing concepts of what service they could provide, not to mention limited funding. We'll be looking at the big picture for libraries with two library science professors from the University of Illinois. And that's on Wednesday's show. Focus is live each weekday morning at 10 with a replay at 8 p.m. on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. This is Focus on WILL.